Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot.
And today, I'm delighted to be joined by Ekaterina Malieva. She is a physician, researcher, the chief innovation officer, and co-founder of Compass Pathways. Ekaterina, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure.
I had the privilege of hearing you some months ago at a presentation where you talked about some of the history of the company, the direction that you have. Before we get into that, could you share a little bit of your background for the listeners so that they understand your perspective and where you're coming from?
Sure. I am a physician, mostly a clinician. So I was trained in internal medicine and was in private practice, academic medicine, and public health for many years in New York. Then eventually moved to London and worked in public health and medical philanthropy. So that's my background.
So you and I share a little bit of a flip, as it were. I obviously, most people know I have a British accent, although I've got, you know, somewhat of a muddled history. I'd moved to the US. You were obviously working in the US and moved to the UK. Is there a story behind that?
Yeah, we moved to London mostly for my husband's work, who worked in multi-stakeholder collaboration in space like pharmaceutical industry and corporate governance and finance. So it was a work-related move, which we enjoyed very much.
Fantastic. And, you know, love London, to be clear. I spent a long time and trained there. So I'm, you know, envious for you and excited that you've obviously taken that move and have founded a company, Compass Pathways. Tell us a little bit about that and how that started and what the story is behind that.
Yeah, it was what I called an involuntary startup. So when we moved to London, I worked in medical philanthropy in the space of HIV and public health in Africa. And at that time, my son was in the US and he developed severe depression and OCD. So in the next 2 years after his diagnosis, we spent a lot of time seeing experts, and he received care in major institutions, and he got remarkably worse. So I felt that I needed to take the matter in my own hands. And after 2 years, I started doing additional research. And in one of my sleepless nights, I found research in psilocybin for patients with OCD. In this small study, 9 patients with OCD took psilocybin in control setting and all got better the next day. So I started looking into this research, and the results and the signals coming out of this research were just remarkable, something that has never been seen in psychiatry. And by that time, I already understood what a dire need there was, because on my journey to find solutions for my son, I shared our story and I listened to other stories, and I just realized that no one is spared. Everyone had a story. Everyone had either a family member or a friend affected by mental health crisis. And I don't know really what was more traumatic, whether it was to see my son's suffering or to hear all the stories and to see this all-pervasive need and all-pervasive suffering. As a physician, as a clinician, I was trained to walk into the room and diagnose the patient, run the test, solve the problem, discharge the patient, and that was my satisfaction. So in this mental health care space, things were completely different. And I just refused to take, to accept this outcome of ineffective treatments, lack of access to quality care, lack of access to evidence-based care. So that's how basically Compass came into existence.
You know, I have to say that it's impossible for me to believe that there is not a single person listening to this that cannot resonate with that story. And if it doesn't resonate with them, it's just not yet. Because this problem of mental health has been so expansive, ultimately, I don't think we really understand why we're seeing increases. There's certainly some thoughts about it, and your sort of commentary about the challenge. And I think what really stuck out to me was the 2 years. I cannot imagine as a parent experiencing 2 years of this stress that essentially imposes on you because you want to do everything and know as a clinician that there are essentially opportunities. So, you know, an incredible drive. And I always find that the origin story is a big sort of driver for success of companies and really focus. Yeah. So you looked at that, you essentially built or built a company. Can you share a little bit of the background as to how that came about? And, you know, obviously you've got co-founders and other people. What happened next?
So when we realized that there might be a potential in this class of drugs called psychedelics and psilocybin in particular, we started supporting research philanthropically. So we've connected with academics. We've connected with Hefter Research Institute. It's a nonprofit organization that at that time and still is supporting research in psilocybin. And this organization was formed by visionary researchers who were carrying the torch, the skills and understanding of the substances for decades, not because, but in spite of all the obstacles at risk for their careers and, you know, being funded on shoestring budget. So we've connected with them and we started supporting research. And then we realized that the need is so great and so urgent that, and then the scientists, the academics simply don't have the skills to bring the treatments to patients. It's a completely different set of skills, completely different stream of funding and the amount of funding that is required. So that's how we started thinking about putting our skills together. So my husband was working in this space with regulators and, pharmaceutical industry and social innovation. And, you know, I was a clinician. I could read and understand medical literature to the extent possible. And then our third co-founder, Lars Wilder, is, a person with extensive business experience and private equity experience. So we came together bringing different kind of sides of expertise and knowledge. And that's how we formed the company.
Fantastic. So I certainly have an audience that's tilted towards healthcare, but, you know, just for clarity, let's cover what psilocybin is. Can you explain what that chemical drug is and a little bit of the history? Because I think it's relevant to this, right?
So psilocybin is an active ingredient in certain species of mushrooms, sometimes called magic mushrooms.
Right.
It's a psychoactive ingredient that causes a particular type of experience. It's a mind-altering or non-ordinary state of consciousness with perceptual disturbances, distortions, pseudo hallucinations and things like that. So it used in kind of ritualistic settings by indigenous people. And when it made its way to the West, it was first synthesized by Sandoz and then was used a little bit in research and clinical research and practice. And that was before the current standards of regulatory standards of drug approvals were introduced. Before, these current standards were introduced, Sandoz actually took psilocybin off the market because there were new, at that time perceived as more promising treatments. It was purely a commercial decision. It was actually not a political decision. But psilocybin escaped. Yeah, the psilocybin escaped the kind of the labs and the, clinical practices and became a recreational drug of abuse or use, misuse, right, however you want to look at it. And then eventually was scheduled. And currently it's a Schedule I substance. And according to Schedule I definition, it means that it doesn't have medical use and has a high potential for, which is current research shows that it's exactly opposite.
No, so I think that's exactly right. It's, you know, the damage that was done by the sort of misuse or misrepresentation. This is not, you know, everybody sort of pitches back to the 60s and whatever. This is a clinical drug with extraordinarily important and relevant elements that can actually contribute to a positive outcome. I personally sort of learned about this a number of years ago when I saw a presentation that talked about its use in death. And what was really fascinating to me is that the effect, the positive clinical effects occur beyond the experience, which can last, you know, a number of hours. And yeah. I think, you know, you've seen some of that, but the problem has been research, as you've highlighted with this Schedule One. It's very, very difficult. Do you see some of that potentially changing, hopefully?
Yes, definitely. Well, you are probably aware of all the efforts of descheduling psilocybin in the US, and similar efforts are in Europe. That, however, is completely different from the issue of psilocybin potential for treatment of mental illnesses. So we approach it not from the political or ideological point of view. We approach it strictly from the perspective of its potential to address different mental health challenges. And for that purposes, enormous amount of research is still ahead of us, and we still need to understand, you know, the exact mechanisms of how it works. But based on the current research, one particular feature of psilocybin and similar substances that stands out is that this feature is transdiagnostic, which means that it works, you know, across different seemingly separate clinical entities: depression, OCD, addiction, death-related anxiety. The psilocybin, one dose of psilocybin can cause significant and immediate decrease of symptoms as soon as the next day. And this relief is maintained for up to 3 weeks, up to 3 months, sometimes 6 months, sometimes up to a year. So that has, again, never been seen in psychiatry, and it seems really, really promising.
That's amazing. So for those of you just joining, I'm Dr. Nick, the incrementalist, and today I'm delighted to be talking to Dr. Ekaterina Malieska. She is the Chief Innovation Officer and co-founder at Compass Pathways. We were just sort of diving in a little bit into psilocybin, some of the effects. As you describe them, it almost, to me, sounds like a wonder drug in terms of outcomes. You know, it'd be hard to find a drug that has that kind of level of persistence, right? I mean, I can't think of anywhere else in medicine where we have that level of sort of persistence of effect.
Yeah, and I think the challenge here is not to approach it as a solution to all our problems. I think the challenge here is to stay sober, stay focused, and actually understand what is happening, because doing more research in the mechanisms of action, and not only mechanism of action, but mechanism of change, will allow us to understand, potentially have new therapeutic targets and develop more focused interventions. So I think it's essential to understand what causes this sustained relief of symptoms, this longevity effects for a long period of time, which, you know, we haven't seen previously with any of the treatments.
Fantastic. So, you know, pivoting a little bit, because I know Compass Pathways, you know, is a broad company focused on mental health, and importantly, solving that problem that you had as a parent, as a clinician listening to others, of access. Tell us a little bit about the sort of broad programs that you have and how you get there.
Right. So we are not a psychedelic company. I know everyone is very excited about psilocybin and psychedelics in general, and it's in the news all the time. But we are not a psychedelic company. We are substance agnostic. We focus on accelerating access to patients, access to evidence-based innovation in mental health. So, and access is complex. It requires, you know, an intervention. It requires the understanding of the set and setting in which the treatment is most effective. It requires understanding which patients would respond better than others. It would require the buy-in from the regulators and more importantly, from health systems and payers. So all these facets would need to be addressed in order to actually solve this problem of bringing this novel effective treatments to patients and to make a dent in mental health crisis that we're currently experiencing.
So
in terms of the broader, go ahead.
No. So I was just going to say, keep going. Fascinated to know how you're sort of expanding that and broadening the access for everybody. What's the sort of process that you go through?
So at the moment, we've received a breakthrough therapy designation by FDA for our program of psilocybin for treatment-resistant depression.
That is not a trivial task.
Not a trivial task. Yes, it's a real recognition of, you know, the efforts of the entire field. It's not, you know, something that we entirely take credit for. But going back to this, so treatment-resistant depression is a huge unmet need, and it's defined as a depression that has not responded to at least two pharmacological treatments. And at the moment, there are over 100 million people around the world with treatment-resistant depression. That means that there are no treatments that work for these patients. So you could imagine that it's a huge, huge problem. So we are in the middle of phase 2B clinical trials of psilocybin for treatment-resistant depression, and the trial is at 20 sites in nine different countries around the world, in Europe, US, and Canada. We're right in the middle of the trial, which is going fairly well. We are in close conversations with regulators, with European Medicines Agency and FDA and regulators in other countries in order to understand what kind of evidence the regulators would need to see to consider the approval and marketing authorization of this drug. Because it's such a new treatment, such an unusual treatment, and there is no precedent for that. We all need to come together in order to solve this problem. There is no regulatory precedence. There is no payer precedence. And the, you know, conversations with payers are equally important because this treatment needs to be integrated into health systems. It needs to be covered by insurances or national health systems. So again, we need to understand what. Are we developing the right treatment that payers would be willing to accept? If you look at Spravato, the esketamine that was successfully developed by Janssen, and now, you know, NICE, the National Institute of Healthcare Excellence in the U.S., that, you know, provides guidelines for adoption of treatments and coverage, refused to cover the cost of this treatment for patients with treatment-resistant depression. So we need to start this conversation early to make sure that we're developing the treatments that will actually be available for patients regardless of their ability to pay. So we're in the middle of all of this. There are, you know, other indications that we're considering, and there are other, you know, there is a pipeline in R&D that, you know, we also considering. Perhaps it's too early to talk about this in more details, but we're taking a broader approach. We're really substance agnostic in that sense. So we would go and look very carefully and consider any innovation that would come our way if we think there is a potential to make a difference in patients' outcomes.
Fantastic. So as I sort of look back, I mean, this has been a relatively long journey, at least, you know, in broad terms, certainly from the origin and the process, I think some exciting developments. As you look back, are there any instances of small improvements or things that you discovered that were really sort of revelatory that you go, wow, that made a big difference in hindsight? Maybe you didn't see it at the time.
Well, actually, that's the life of a day in the life of a small, agile, mission-driven company. You just have to stay aware to all the signals that are coming from your work, close the loop, pay attention to feedback, and make this constant course corrections. So in a way, they become really a, you know, it's so integrated in your life that, it, that they become essentially unnoticeable. So you don't just wake up and decide to disrupt the mental health care or, you know, pharmaceutical industry. That change happens really incrementally. So one of the, I think, the way I look at it is we've changed the angles. We slightly changed the angle of the conversation about psilocybin and the role of psilocybin in mental health. So we changed from medicalization of psychedelics to focusing on patients and patients' outcomes and the significant unmet need in mental health. And all of a sudden, the regulators and the payers and everybody else we would talk to would pay attention. We would walk into the room full of regulators. You know, we had a scientific advice with European Medicines Agency, 28 member states, and we would talk about the role of patient experience and enormous amount of suffering and how we need innovation in mental health and how promising this treatment could be. And you would see people nodding, and all of a sudden we're all on the same on the same side of the fence. You know, we're not divided by our respective lines of work. We're all in it together because, as I said in the beginning, no one is spared.
Fantastic. I'm, you know, I've got to be honest. I listen to that and think, wow, that's just a sort of perfect summarization of the passion I feel for these small changes. And you know, what you said was that they almost become unnoticeable, which I think is a fascinating insight. I think that's the point about this incremental approach. You know, we're all looking for the exponential, but it's hard to sort of get there. And sometimes in hindsight, you go back and you look and think, wow, all of that innovation. So we've a little bit of time left in the last minute or so. Could you share some thoughts about where this is going and you know, some of the future opportunities that you see and what's exciting for you?
Yeah, what's exciting is, again, the solving all these problems that come our way. And, you know, as I said, we working with regulators very closely. There is an it might be an oxymoron, regulatory innovation, but we are excited about it. We're working now in psychiatry with the tools that were created in 60s and 70s, and research tools and methods that were created in the last century might not be suitable for, you know, new treatment paradigms that we're developing. So we're working closely with regulators to adapt these existing tools in order to, you know, expedite the development of these new treatments. And the same goes with payers, and we're looking at our, you know, pipeline. And I think one of the most exciting parts, what I think the main challenge of this area of research is that it's a highly technical climb. This last part is a highly technical climb. You cannot get away with just enthusiasm or good intentions. It requires enormous amount of expertise, funding, the whole range of expertise. And so it's a teamwork and collaboration. And that's the only way that we could get where we want to go.
Wow. I think so excited by the potential of this. You know, truly the groundbreaking aspects of, you know, changing the conversation. I think that's what I heard very clearly, the teamwork-based approach. And specifically, you know, I like to hear this, you know, combination of regulation, private innovation. I've not heard regulatory innovation, but I think the FDA, certainly the FDA that I experience, wildly different to the sort of, you know, challenging organization that everybody believes suppressed innovation. That's not their intent. It's about safety, and cooperation is so important. So extraordinary. I'm just so excited. Unfortunately, as usual, we've run out of time. So it just remains for me to thank you, Ekaterina, for joining me today. It's been a delightful conversation, and I'm really excited about where you're going and where you're taking us.
Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you.
Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, The Incrementalist, or share with me at DrNick1 on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com. And tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.